This is the Photography Podcast on photography.ca, episode number 29 for October 1, 2007. Hey there, everyone. How's it going? And welcome to the Photography Podcast on photography.ca. We're talking about episode number 29 already, and we're coming from Montreal on October 1, 2007. Well, for today's show, we have a really cool interview with fine art photographer Raphael Goldchain. But before we get into that, I just want to say thanks very much to a couple of people that left some comments on last episode's topic of posing models in photography. Both Darren J. and Gary H. Left some comments, and they thought the podcast was very useful. So thanks so much for those comments. That podcast was actually created because of a comment that we received from Darren J. And it's my pleasure to do podcasts on people's suggestions. So if there's something you want to know about, please just suggest it. And if I can do it, I'll do it. And if I can find someone that knows more about it than I do, I'll try and invite them on and we'll try and cover the topic for you. As always, comments can be left by just emailing me, photography.ca@gmail.com. And of course, you can also leave comments directly on the blog, photography.ca/blog. You can subscribe for free in iTunes or Google Reader just by clicking the subscribe button on the front page of the blog. And that way you'll be updated every time we put one out. So now on to today's main interview, which is an interview with Raphael Goldchain. And Raphael is a fine art photographer working in Ontario. He is a professor and the program coordinator of the Applied Photography Program at Sheridan College. And I think that's now known as the Sheridan College Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning. So this is an in-depth interview, and it kind of focuses on one of Raphael's more recent projects, a project called On Familial Ground, where he basically goes through his family history by using himself to create self-portraits, referencing where he comes from and getting in touch with his past. And that's just one element. So this is an in-depth interview. It's about 40 minutes long. And Raphael also talks about how the photographs were created, the lighting he used, as well as the post-processing that was done. So it's a really packed full of information interview that we have going with Raphael. Instead of talking about it, as always, let's just get right into it now. So I'd like very much to welcome a special guest to today's podcast. And the guest is Raphael Goldchain. And he's a fantastic photographer. And I've been following his work for a number of years. And it's a true pleasure to welcome him to this podcast. So hey there, Raphael. Welcome.
Hello there. How are you?
Excellent. So happy to have you with us today.
Thank you. Same here.
Excellent. So I thought we'd start off just really quickly. You know, the fine art photography world is a small world for those that don't know much about it. So I thought maybe you could, you know, basically describe a little bit about your biography, where you come from, a little bit about your history in photography.
Well, I don't know how far back you want me to go, but, you know, like many other people who are involved in photography, started on early in life with a fascination in my early teens. And eventually, after a stint in science and university in Jerusalem and Israel, I ended up at Ryerson here in Toronto. And I went there for 4 years, and I graduated with Bachelor of Applied Arts in Photography. I took, at Ryerson, they have many streams, and they had many streams back then, too. I took the what was called the Media Studies option, which was more the sort of geeky, fine arty, more philosophical and aesthetically driven option rather than the more commercial and applied option or the cinematography option. So, you know, I you know, chose the losing track right from the beginning. That in hand, of course, I went to a job which was the complete opposite of what I had been trained for. I spent 9 years as a medical photographer at one of the Toronto's downtown teaching hospitals.
Wow, that's super cool.
Well, it was in that it gave me a lot of technical ability and a place to work and an income and a wonderful home for 9 years. And I'm still very much, in touch with people there. And I learned lots of technical stuff, and I also learned to deal with the world as a photographer. the small world of the hospital, but it was a varied world. Many types of clients, many types of jobs, many types of processes that I had to learn to do. And I had some wonderful mentors there as well. So it was a great training ground after Ryerson. And during that time, I also developed a fine art practice, mostly as a straight color photographer. It was the late 70s, early 80s, and color photography was starting to lose its stigma as a commercial medium. And many fine art photographers, such as Joel Marowitz, Susan Micellus, and others, were starting to use it for expressive and fine art purposes. And I was, I started using color in my second year at Ryerson and developed it further in my third and fourth year. By the time I graduated, I was using color on my own, like uniquely. And by 1983 or so, I was having some exhibitions. In 1985 and 86, I had a couple of Canada Council grants, a small one and a larger one, which enabled me to travel a lot. In 1986, actually, I took a year off from the hospital and went off and traveled in Mexico and Central America, and that lasted until 1987. After that, I kept on going back for periods of 2 or 3 months at a time, and all of that culminated in a couple of exhibitions, one that traveled Canada from about 1987 to about 1991, and another one, I showed in various incarnations and forms up until not too long ago, starting about 1992. Where else does it go? In the 90s, I was freelancing and was exhibiting, and I didn't have a job anymore, but I did start teaching part-time. And in 1994 and 1995, I started teaching at Sheridan College, was known at the time as Sheridan College. It's now known as Sheridan Institute of Technology and Advanced Learning. And at Humber College, which I think has also undergone a name change.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate in those two institutions to encounter wonderful colleagues and mentors. And it allowed me to develop as a teacher and to make an honest living, causing the least amount of damage to society it could possibly cause. And in 1998, I decided that, well, earlier on, I'd been considering for many years, but the opportunity to go back to school as a graduate student came up in 1998, and I was extremely lucky to be accepted to York University's program, a Master of Fine Arts program, due to the wonderful offices of some very good friends. And, of course, hopefully, what I had done previously as an artist got me in there.
Because it's hard to get into that college, isn't it?
It is hard. It's a very small program, so it's very competitive. And even though I had done much straight photography or, personal straight photography up until then, this wasn't something that they were necessarily interested in. And I think, I don't know how I got in there. I think maybe some of my writing, which was quite critical, might have persuaded some that, I was worth investing in, despite my age, because I think I was like 40, 44 or 45 when I got in there. Anyway, I spent two wonderful years at York, difficult and at times excruciating, but, maybe that's the nature of education. You have to go through some transformation and not always comfortable. And, at the end of that, I was much the better. And it was, it was a good timing for me in terms of my teaching career, because shortly thereafter, you really couldn't get a teaching job anywhere without a master's degree. And as it turned out, I got hired full-time at Sheridan in 2001.
And you're still working there now, is that
still
right?
Still there.
Okay.
I had wonderful six years as a full-time prof there. And then this year in September, I was offered the job of program coordinator after the retirement of my colleague and mentor, Henry Bisher. For 6 years, I learned with him and watched him work, and I absorbed his way of doing things, and then I stepped into his shoes this year.
Excellent.
Which are pretty big shoes, actually. I guess there's a lot more details I could tell you, but that's a long answer to a short question.
Okay. Well, it's a good start, and I think our listeners are always interested into how people get their start. So thanks for the bio.
Okay.
I guess I wanted to get into some of your latest work. And just backtracking, you know, 2 or 3 minutes or so, as some of the people to photography.ca may have seen, they may have already seen some of your previous work that you mentioned, work that you had taken when you traveled to Mexico. And I'm going to put some additional links to that older work, as well as some new links to the work that we're going to talk about now. But for this work, that fascinated me. I must tell you, Raphael, I see lots and lots of work, and I'm fascinated by a lot of work. But when I came across your work, and it's not even that recent, I hate to say it, it started like 7 or 8 years ago, but I guess we're talking about the work in a body of work called Familial Ground. Mm-hmm. And these are portraits, and I'll let you get into exactly what type of portraits they are, but they seem to be autobiographical portraits based on your ancestry. Is that somewhat of a good...
Yeah, that's a good practical definition, a good description.
But these are actually, they're self-portraits, are they not?
They're self-portraits, yeah.
Okay, and they are super darn cool. They're so cool. There's, how many portraits? Is there like 20, 25, 30 portraits?
Well, out on the web right now, there may be somewhere between 20 and 30. In total right now, I've made about 55.
Wow.
So, and they will be published next year, around this time, September, October, by Princeton Architectural Press in New York as a book called On Familial Ground.
Wow. So each one, so just so our listeners can get an idea of what went on, you basically delved into your family history. Why don't you describe the genesis of the project, let's say? And then we'll talk maybe more about a few individual photographs that are unbelievable, actually.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for being so complimentary about the work. I get a bit embarrassed when people do that, but anyway, I'll overcome that.
Thank you.
You know, the whole idea about family history and ancestry is kind of a vehicle for me. It, like in any work, there are several strands of thought and that come together. And one of the strands was my abiding interest in portraiture and my desire to become a better portrait photographer. And I knew that would take years. And not having formal training in a portrait photographer studio, and just the benefit of my reading and the benefit of... I'm just going to close the door here because somebody's using a vacuum cleaner elsewhere in the house. Not good timing. Anyway, that was one strand. And my fascination with portrait photography in general, but also particularly the portrait photography that was done by anonymous studios, way back when there weren't so many cameras in people's homes, and the snapshot was not quite as prevalent as it is now, and people went to the studio to be photographed. And there is something really beautiful and enchanting about those portraits. And at the same time, I was... coming across these kinds of portraits from Jewish history in Europe, Poland particularly, in books and also in museums. And there was the added emotional charge of knowing that many of the people in the portraits suffered a horrible end.
Right.
And then at the same time as that was happening, in the same years, I started coming into possession of portraits of ancestors of mine that I had no idea that these images existed. They came to me via relatives of various degrees of separation. And these were the same kinds of portraits, shot in the teens and the 20s and the 30s in groups or individuals that these people were actually related to me by blood. And this was, earth-shaking for me because I had grown up in a very, very small family in Santiago, Chile, far, far away from Poland, knowing that they had been a family at one point, but there wasn't any more. Being vaguely aware that there were family members scattered throughout the world, but nobody made beans out of this. And so there was basically a shallow history in my awareness, right? My history did not have any details reaching back into the past. And all of a sudden, these details were coming to me in the form of portrait photographs. So that was one stream. The other more sort of esoteric or philosophical, if you like, I think underpinning some of the reasons, motivations for doing photographic work, I guess during my Ryerson years, at some point I discovered, or I was pointed to by very wise people, that the best photographs came from deep knowledge of the subject, and that somebody at some point said to me, photograph what you know. and you know, and growing awareness of the deep connection between one's own self and the world, and one's sense of where one sits in the world, and how one represents it. And that, you know, good photographs come from, you know, a thoughtful connection to the world. And so from there starts a preoccupation with what is it that I know about the world? What is my position in the world? And the relationship between who I am in my own background and how I look at things. And so, you know, this work from Central America and Mexico came from there, and that, you know, trying to in some way connect with an identity as a Latin American, which got a bit interrupted back in my teens when I left Chile for Israel, and which was it resumed in the mid-70s through visits to my family, and all of a sudden I'm back in a Latin American environment. Oh my gosh, this is part of me, but I feel the connection is interrupted. So I rebuilt that connection. There was a desire to become a Latin American artist and to belong to the collective of Latin American art through the work. So the connection between the work and identity, I guess, is what I'm trying to lead to. Then in the late 90s, while at York University, I was presented with the same problem. I didn't want to be a street photographer anymore. That was over for me. And I wanted to, you know, continue to make work that was that would be meaningful to me, that didn't feel like I was just going through the paces of making photographs for, just for the hell of it. So what kinds of photographs to make? And I didn't want to be, I wanted to work in the studio with portraiture. And I ended up, you know, using myself as a model because I was available.
Well, yeah, yeah, your fees to model were very reasonable.
Available, reasonable rates.
Yeah.
And not and you know, easy to work with.
Yeah.
You know, not too hard to look at.
Right, right, right.
And also, you know, on a more serious basis, I really wanted to make a more direct connection between the work and the issue of, you know, identity as a moving target. You know, because you know, I have, in a way, three national identities or, you know, cultural identities that are always in flux with one another, you know, the Canadian, the Latin American, and the Jewish. And it's a daily negotiation between all three of them that makes me who I am.
But it's so interesting, actually, because, like, I've seen the portraits that are on the web now, and again, we'll put some links for other people to see them. And you're totally right. Even from my perspective, I can see those different identities coming through in the individual self-portraits. I totally can. Certain shots look more, you know, in quotation marks, Latin American or Jewish. You can actually see the differences within the portraits.
Well, you know, anyway, the reference images,
yes.
And you can see that in the titles too. You know, range from Poland to Latin America as the years wear on, and the dates are also on the titles of the images, which is a really important part of the work because it locates the images in different parts of the world, and the clothing styles and the photography styles change. I try to, in some way, work with those elements to locate the photographs within particular time periods and, you know, and locations in the world. So, yeah, so while I was at York, I did a whole bunch of self-portraits, some of them very campy, some of them quite over the top in terms of costumes, and eventually I did one in which I was seeking to create characters from memory and from imagination. And I did one in which I represented a maternal grandfather and sitting with my committee at York, which was Brenda Longfellow, Tim Whiten, and Yvonne Singer. They pointed, you know, I had 40 or 50 portraits on the wall in the studio, and they all pointed to that one and said, that's the one that has the most emotional intensity.
What's the title of that one?
That one is actually not in the body of work because currently on the web because it had some technical problems.
Okay.
So even though it had technical problems, which I solved afterwards, I went and recreated it.
Okay.
And the recreation shows me in a fedora holding a newspaper wrapped bundle under my arm.
Okay.
And so that's the second the second attempt at the same image.
Because I'm actually, it's too funny. I have three images that I wanted to talk about, and I believe that's one of them. Is that self-portrait as Don Moises Rubenstein Krongold?
That's right.
Okay. It's one of the ones I wanted to talk about, actually, and it's a very, very striking portrait.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, he was very much part of my life for many years because, you know, it's my maternal grandfather, I remember him because we used to go, when I was little, we used to go to his house with certain frequency, or he used to take my brother and I to shul. But also, after my grandmother died in 1964, he moved to our house to live with us.
Wow.
So he lived in our house for many years, and I remember him vividly. And so the portrait really comes from that memory, but also comes out of a wish to try to imagine him as he might have been when he first arrived in Chile from Poland. He had been in Venezuela for a number of years. So let's say as he first arrived in Venezuela, for all that matters, as a Polish Jew with no Spanish and with just a desire to build a life, you know, so before my birth. And I remembered that what he did was he sold men's apparel, and he did that door to door. So what's in the bundle is really a man's shirt.
Okay, that's one of the things that any viewer of photography gets to enjoy, creating their own backstory to the portrait. They may not know what's in the bundle, and then they create their own story.
Yeah, he was a melancholic kind of character. You know, he wasn't somebody who had a lot of joie de vivre.
Yeah.
Although occasionally he told joke or two, and he reminisced about Poland, although my brother and I were not that interested. And we thought that was all behind, and there was no sense in thinking about all back there. Of course, we never had that. You know, he had lived there for years.
Right, right.
And he was sad, especially after the death of my grandmother. He was not a happy person, and as he got older, I think he got more and more unhappy. And even though he lived with us, I think he was quite lonely, and he had quite a complicated relationship with my mother. So I think all of that is in the bitterness of the facial expression that I tried to create.
And even in, if I'm not mistaken, you also did another one of him even later in life. Is that correct?
Actually, the one where he's balder.
Yes, exactly.
Is earlier.
Oh, it's earlier. Okay.
Yeah. It's
okay.
Just as he arrives in Venezuela, there's a picture taken, or just before he leaves Poland, there is a picture taken with him and my grandmother and my mother as an 8-year-old child. And or young child, I don't know that she was 8, but she was in that neighborhood anyway. So that picture of him is sort of a fragment, a detail of that picture that's recreated. And if you look in the body of work, there's a picture of his wife, my grandmother, as well, with a chair,
right?
The back of a chair. That's another detail of the same portrait.
And that's really, it's one of the things that attract, I mean, there's a number of things that attract me to the work, but one of them in particular is the story aspect of each image. I mean, one of the things that I love also as a photographer is when images tell a story. You have one frame to tell a story, and, you know, not all images tell a story. Sometimes they're just souvenirs. But for me, the better images always tell a story or suggest a story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the aspects that I found in each of these portraits, was that they actually told a story. And, you know, I guess that goes back to your intense research of the subjects and what you try to achieve with your facial expression, also telling a story, perhaps somewhat thinking about what they may have gone through during that time, trying to portray that. Is that a fair statement?
I certainly that was on my mind, but there were many other things on my mind. You know, I had some reference images, and you know, I was, you know, fascinated with the portraiture aspect of things and learning how those portrait photographers had done things back then, how they posed their subjects, how they lit their subjects, and how they told their subjects to stand there, and how they told their subjects to look, and, you know, and what kind of performance they got from their subjects. And so that was part of it too. And, you know, in the studio while in production, you know, working with Polaroid, trying to find a particular pose that would look strong and would look in some ways reminiscent, but not a slavish recreation of the original reference image that I might have had in front of me.
Right.
But I also certainly was aware of the history of most of the people that I recreated or reenacted. And so that was part of my thinking as well.
Had you ever taken an acting course?
No.
Because a lot of them are act. They're very strong. They're very strong. They're very emotional. There's one in particular, one of the ones that I have, just looking, self-portrait as Reitzel Goldchain. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Am I?
Reitzel.
That's a very powerful portrait. I'm looking at it right now on my monitor, and it's very powerful.
It's funny how things like that happen, you know. So much is really happens in the doing.
Yeah.
I mean, you can only plan so much, but then you're in the studio and you've got, you know, your elements that you're working with and the people that you're working with, and a creation emerges right there. The way that portrait happened is I had a portrait of a distant relative as a reference, but, you know, it was only a reference, and the final product doesn't look at all like, so there's not even a shadow of a recreation of anything that existed. But I also had, and this happened at the end of a shooting session. We'd done a bunch of other things. And so I was there with a makeup artist and my assistant, who's actually, assistant is a bad word for it. It's collaborator.
Collaborator, yeah.
Yeah, Adrian Fish, who's now a professor at NASCAD University in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Oh, excellent.
Anyway, you know, I mentioned to the makeup artist that I had bought a wig at some point and that I didn't quite know what to do with it. And I dug it out of my kit and I showed it to her, and she said, let me do something with it. And so she styled it, and I had some clothing that I put on, and she styled it, and you know, we went on to make a Polaroid, and all of us agreed that this was something that had a lot of potential, so we just worked with it. And in the end, I sketched out a character that that I thought would be somebody that would be part of almost any family, somebody who's just a little bit depressed,
yeah,
a little bit off,
yeah.
But quite beautiful in doing that, and that's how that portrait emerged. It's completely a studio creation.
An effective one, though. It's very powerful, as I'm sure you've been told by other people as well.
Yeah, it says there are people who have a predilection for that image for sure.
I guess I also, since we're talking about it, would you be able to describe the lighting technique that you used? Let's say for that portrait and other portraits.
For the majority of these images, I've used a medium-sized softbox made by Plume called a wafer light, which is a shallow softbox. And it has a diffuser in the front, but it also has baffles. And so all of these things are removable. And sometimes I remove the diffuser for harder light, or I put it on for softer light and change the baffles inside the wafer light to change the quality of the lighting for more focused to less focused. The inside of the wafer light is also lined with stripes of silver foil. So you have a combination of soft and hard light. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful light source. And that's, you know, there's a strobe light. There's a strobe head inside this this soft box, right?
Right.
And so that's the main light. And then for a fill, sometimes we use a big sheet of styrofoam.
Okay.
Like a 4x8 sheet of styrofoam held up by a stand. Or a collapsible reflector with either a silver or a white surface.
Okay, so one main light on the subject and some...
And a reflector.
And a reflector.
We may use a secondary light onto the reflector.
Okay.
To control the reflector a little more.
Okay.
And then there's a third light on the background.
Yeah, which we can clearly see, especially in that portrait.
Yeah, and in some of them, I think we used also a kicker light from the back, to kind of pick up a few highlights in the hair and separate me from the background a bit. So there's maximum four lights.
Okay.
Some of them are very simple. It's just two lights, especially the earlier ones. As we moved on and as the years wore on, we started getting a little more adventuresome with the lighting. And also period-wise, you know, for the images that simulate, you know, a 40s or 50s, we started using more lights. So that's the lighting pattern.
And what would you have used as a camera to record these images?
I use a wooden folding 4x5, and it's a field 4x5, with mostly with a 210 Rudenstock lens.
Okay, so these are not quick and easy portraits. This is a lot of setup time. Each portrait session could last several hours, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we start at 9 o'clock and finish by 5 or 6 o'clock and be exhausted.
Really? And that's for one setup?
No, sometimes two, sometimes three.
Okay.
Depending on the complexity. The more makeup, the more complex, the more hair, the less setups we'd be able to do in a day. So some of the women, which are, you know, the self-portraits that are most complex, because of the degree of transformation, you know, they're a lot more elaborate and they would take a long time, and maybe we'd get two done in a day.
Wow. So it's quite a little, I mean, the results are unbelievable, but it is a laborious process to get to those results.
Yeah. I mean, there's the 4x5 in which shoot Polaroid, 4x5 Polaroid, until we, you know, got something that was starting to look interesting, and, you know, we'd probably shoot maybe anytime, anywhere from 3 to 10 Polaroids to get to an interesting point, and then we'd start shooting film, and we'd shoot anywhere from 10 to 15 sheets of film. And then the film gets processed, and a contact sheet gets made in black and white. The film, by the way, I shot color film.
Color film, okay.
Yeah. It's just easier, and for the purposes of this project, I didn't need to, you know, go into a special, you know, black and white film with a special developer zone system and all of that. That wasn't necessary. I love shooting color in any case, and by shooting color and scanning it, I was able to apply digital filters and change the rendition of the grayscale based on which colors are privileged.
Okay.
Just to give you the film gets a contact sheet and then edit, and then I take my selects to a lab and I get them drum scanned. So then I take the drum scans and they're in color, and then I convert them to black and white. So if I want a lighter rendition of the skin, I favor the red filter. If I want a darker rendition of the skin, I favor the blue filter.
And this is done in a program like Photoshop?
In Photoshop, yeah.
Okay.
And then there's extensive digital manipulation or retouching, changing facial features, retouching of the skin, and alteration of the lighting pattern, and sometimes just extensive dodging and burning to create features that or eliminate features. You know, for example, you know, my Adam's apple had to come out of a lot of the portraits in which I represent women.
Right.
And otherwise, you know, in my judgment, then I felt I looked too masculine.
Right.
And I wanted to take the retouching to a point where there was an ambiguity there, because the viewer eventually knows it's a man posing as a woman.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to take that ambiguity as far as I could.
Actually, in some of them, yes, I agree, you know. In some of them, you're not so sure. I mean,
yeah.
Like, because it's a series, yes, you know, at the end of the day, I think people realize it's you.
Sure.
And you're a man. But in some of them, the retouching is so deft that you're not 100% sure if it is a man at first glance, shall we say.
Yeah. So, the removal of Adam's apple is all done using dodging and burning to alter the highlights and shadows, you know, and then there's, you know, alteration of facial features and then alteration of the tonalities. And in the case of the younger women, you know, smoothing of the skin and applying sort of digital makeup. There's multiple items of digital manipulation in each one of them.
And thank you for being free and sharing that. Just for those listeners that are wondering how long this type of post-processing work takes in Photoshop, what would an average session be like in terms of hours?
Well, for each one of them, I'd say on the average, a full day.
A full day, wow. In Photoshop?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, they are striking, so sometimes it's good to know that in order to get something looking so good, you got to work damn hard to get
it. It's a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, especially working with your own face, eventually you kind of lose sight of the fact that you're working on your own face, and it just becomes a portrait.
Right. And then I guess one of the last things I wanted to talk about, I was blown away actually by the printing and just how good it looks on my monitor. And then speaking with you, you've mentioned that the actual prints, which are they 30 by 40 inches?
30 by 40, yeah.
30 by 40 inches. What was the printing like to get the images that large, and how do they look that large?
Well, if any of your listeners saw the work at the Model à Photo 2005 at the City Bronfman Center in Montreal, those were RA4 prints made in a color darkroom.
Wow.
So what I ended up doing was I took my digital files back to the lab, and I had them output a 4x5 negative using a film recorder. This process is no longer possible. The film recorder is just, it's a dying technology, and the lab will no longer use it to output negatives. They will output transparencies, but not negatives.
Okay.
But anyway, at the time, that was the process, and then I took those output color negatives with a monochrome image on them back to the darkroom, and I made large color prints, monochrome color prints.
Did you print the work yourself?
Yeah, I printed myself.
Okay.
What I'm doing now is I'm basically taking the images as digital files and having them printed on a large format inkjet printer as one process, and the other process is a large format RA4 like a Chimera or a Lightjet 5000, which produces light exposure onto photographic paper, and then RF4 process, but it's a digital process rather than an optical process.
Okay.
And the result is exactly the same. The difference between the darkroom prints and the digital prints is that the darkroom prints had a subtlety of shade to them, sometimes subtly cool shadows and warm highlights, you know, a bit of a crossover of tones, because it's impossible to get totally monochrome image from that kind of optical process, chemical process.
Right.
Whereas the digital are completely neutral. You know, there's no subtle shifting of shades in them.
Which do you prefer?
They both have their charm. At the moment, just for the sake of consistency, so that every print in the body of work has the same tonality in it, which is what I want, the digital process is better.
Okay. Very, very interesting. Super interesting.
The nice thing about the darkroom is that I could look at my first test and I could dodge and burn, you know, and I could make prints that, you know, use my darkroom skills, whereas the digital prints, I really have to have everything done by the time the print goes to the lab to get it printed.
And I guess we're just wondering as well, is this an ongoing project? Have you finished the project now? At what stage are you?
Well, I've finished the book.
Okay.
So the 55 self-portraits, out of which, you know, some editing will happen, are done, and that's going to go into the book, which we publish next year. And I just finished that last week, so I'm now taking a break.
Okay.
As far as finishing the body of work, I don't know yet. I still see that there may be some offshoots. There may be a new direction I can go in, but I'm not trying to figure that out at the moment. I'm taking a break.
Right. And probably a well-deserved break. I just wonder, because I personally have projects also that have lasted years and years and years, and I wonder if they'll ever end. I wonder if, you know, one theme can ever completely dormant, or one day you're just like, ah, you know what? Here's one or two more shots that I got to do that are going to fit in with the rest of the photographs.
Yeah. Yeah, that may happen for sure. And certainly the underlying preoccupations that lead to the making of the work and make the work meaningful and fun continue. You know, those things are not put to rest. They're for life. So whatever work I do in the future, I think those ideas and those preoccupations will be part of it.
Excellent. Well, I think we'll probably end here, unless there's anything else you want to add to the recording.
No, I think that was pretty good. I thank you for the thoroughness of the questions, and certainly any listeners to the podcast are free to email me for any additional information. I'm sure you will have my email posted somewhere there.
Yeah, for sure. We'll have some link. We'll have a few of the photos actually showing. We'll have some links to older work, and if you want us to put in your email for listeners to email you directly, it would be
certainly. If anybody's interested in more information, or, you know, they're free to email me, and I'll be happy to answer as soon as time permits.
Excellent. So thank you so much again, Rafael, for doing this. It was a really thorough interview, and people can really get a feel for what it is to create a body of incredible work from inception to semi or pseudo completion, and the steps involved in getting from A to B.
Thank you so much.
So thanks, Rafael, and I hope to speak to you again sometime in the future.
All right.
Bye for now.
You take care. Bye-bye.
So I'd very much like to thank Rafael Goldchain for doing that interview with us. Such an in-depth interview. I know it's going to be of great interest to a lot of people involved in photographic projects, as well as people who just want to know what it takes to achieve such, you know, masterful lighting and masterful printing. So really, you can check out the links in the show notes, which of course you'll need to accord with this podcast number 29 if you're listening to it in a month or a year from now. But yeah, there's lots of links available, as well as the full series of photographs that Rafael has done up till now on the project that we talked about, On Familial Ground. So there's a couple links we'll put up. We'll also put up a couple of photos so you could see the work straight up and really get a feel for, you know, these amazing, amazing portraits. As always, we'd love to get some comments, and you could do so just by emailing me, photography.ca@gmail.com. And of course, just make your way to the blog, www.photography.ca/blog, and you can leave some comments there as well. So thanks again, everyone. Have a great day, have a great week, and as always, keep on shooting. Bye for now.